From the American Tobacco Historic District, this is The State of Things. I'm David Crabtree. Many of the top grossing movies in cinematic history are war films, immortalizing both fictional and factual heroes from our country's most famous military conflicts. And for civilians, these films are often their only glimpse onto the battlefield and the life of a soldier. So how do these films shape our perceptions and expectations of the military and of war? And in a time of war, do military films mean something more? On this Veterans Day, we welcome your calls this hour at 1-877-962-9862. What images from war films have stayed with you? And were there war films that changed the way you viewed the military? Joining us now is Garrett Scott. He is the director and producer of the documentary Occupation Dreamland, which was filmed in 2004. He's joining us by phone from California. Garrett, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I had a chance to view part of your documentary. Tell us how this came to be, and for those who would be viewing it, what they're going to see.
Well, we went to Iraq in December of 2003, and we linked up with a battalion from the Army's 82nd Airborne. They were in charge of Fallujah at that point. And we connected ourselves to a particular squad from the 82nd and stayed with those guys for 6 weeks until they started to rotate out. They were replaced by the Marines throughout late February and March of 2004. So essentially it's just a day in the life of those guys, eight guys in particular, over the course of that six-week period. And through that experience, you get a glimpse of what was happening in Fallujah as well as things were slowly escalating.
I was struck by what appeared to be, at least to me, amazing access with these guys.
Yeah, they were incredibly generous, and they really welcomed us in and set us up. And, you know, that's all due to their personalities, too, and the openness of the Army, I would say, as well.
Did you get what you were expecting before you landed there in Fallujah, or did you get more?
I think we got more in some ways. You know, I didn't quite know what to expect. I was going to be happy if we were just able to stick with them for, you know, a consistent amount of time. I didn't know, you know, if they'd be resentful of our presence or, you know, if they'd take us in or not. But I was happy with how much each of them as individuals shared about himself, his little world inside of himself. And that's a very striking thing when you're looking at eight guys all in camouflage, you know, the hair shaved, they're looking imposing in their body armor, and you see them out on missions. And then, you know, each one is a totally unique individual inside. So I was very, very happy with that balance.
Yeah, I was struck that they did not all agree with each other, particularly on political issues.
No, you got eight guys. They're all enlisted men. They're from all different parts of the country, all different walks of life, more or less. And, you know, they're going to have very different points of view about the way the world works.
Garrett, if you were describing what your documentary communicates, how would you describe that?
I'd say it describes a certain kind of tedium mixed with, you know, speed and adrenaline and confusion over, you know, like I said, the six-week period. But also I think this sort of main feeling or sense that comes through is just growing frustration because those guys, it's very striking. You're putting people in a set of circumstances where they're mainly on the defensive. And they're an occupying force. They're not taking territory anymore. So they're vulnerable in many ways, and they're waiting to be attacked, and they often don't have the chance to find the enemy, to find payback, to find a sense of release, and that is incredibly frustrating. And they have to be under a lot of self-control, too, because, you know, they might want to shoot at some people, but if the targets aren't there, they have to restrain themselves because that's when things get out of control. So it's very frustrating circumstances, and you can see that growing and developing over the course of the film.
There's a scene in the doc from one of the recruitment meetings for reenlistment. Let's listen to that.
Oh, yeah.
Some of you are, what, 23 years old? Not really know what you want to do with your life. I guarantee you.
You know, I wanted to go to art school, wanted to be a designer. But I knew that I didn't have any money for college. So I went to the recruiter and I was like, you know, I'm only gonna, you know, ask a couple questions about it, you know, and I'm only gonna do like 2 years. That's the max if I like this. And so a couple hours later, I walk out of the office like with 4-year contract. Yeah, I think it was just all the pressure I had just to kind of just to get out of my home and get away.
You can't go home and live with Mama. She's not gonna put up with you anymore. You are not the same person. Your friends back on the block are still doing the dumb, stupid stuff they were doing 3 years ago when you left.
You know, Garrett, even with the stories that the media is doing today on recruitment goals falling short, with the continued frustration of what for some is viewed as by some as what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, this is a different take on this of hearing what the recruiters are saying.
Yeah, well, those guys, they're sergeants who are trying to get these guys to reenlist specifically. But yeah, you don't hear that normally. Well, you know, that's taken from a meeting, a mandatory meeting that people have to go to if they're in their last year and they've decided they're not going to reenlist. At that point, you enter this 1-year window. You have to go to these meetings maybe once every 2 months. You know, and you really get the hard sell. So they do play on the uncertainty and anxiety of being a kid in your 20s. You've been in the Army this time. You don't know how you're going to live the rest of your life, how you're going to pay for college, you know, pay for your apartment, get everything set up. I don't, you know, those are frightening things because everybody's unsure about how to make their life work. So when these dreadful possibilities are held up, it does seem rather frightening. And, you know, ironically enough, they are in the middle of Iraq and going out on these combat missions. But, you know, maybe they should rejoin. That's the question. And it sounds brutal. At the same time, you got to remember that these guys are pretty hard. And they go to these kinds of meetings all the time. It may sound disturbing, and it is disturbing, but, I think they're used to that stuff. I think a lot of it just rolls right off their back. If they decided they're getting out, they probably are.
Garrett, as long as we've had films, we've had wars, particularly in this country. With that in mind, what do you see as the role that war films fill in this society?
I think, if anything, they fill this natural gap of curiosity, of course, and people want to know what it's like. It's a huge mystery. What does happen on the other side? You know, we all want to know. They fill a necessary cultural role in some ways, but I think that role is also abused and addressed and used, you know, to sell tickets. These films are very sensational. They have to be sped up. There has to be a lot of action, a lot of drama, and of course, a war zone is rife with dramatic and fast circumstances. But army life, or I should say, military life, at least in the vast majority of circumstances, is often quite tedious. Quite boring, not a lot of action, not a lot of firefights, very businesslike, very authoritarian, that's an important reality that few people get. That's why, recruiting films are full of high-speed scenes of, you know, people dropping into enemy territory or, you know, leaping out of the water with their weapons ready and, you know, people join the Army or the Navy or the Marines and realize they're just going to be cutting the grass for a year or something or doing whatever they're told. It's often quite different.
Yeah, you know, the films obviously about military are important in shaping public expectations of military and war, but they can also be damaging on those perceptions, can't they?
I think so. I mean, for instance, like, the guys we were with, I was really struck by how much they wanted something to show what they were going through, because of course what they were going through wasn't something that they felt was being seen. So an accurate representation of the tedium, the frustration, the moments where they're ambushed and that, you know, are over almost as fast as they begin. There's no music to announce it. There's no suspense to set you up for the bomb going off. That kind of stuff really throws people off after a while. And, you know, if you go through, if you're a person that goes through this tour or this war one time, several times, I would think in the end, you know, a person would want to see what happened to them. They don't want to see, you know, a bunch of good-looking guys from Hollywood going through the California desert, you know, getting in firefights every 10 minutes, you know, mowing down the enemy in numbers. If that's not what happened to them, if that doesn't reflect their own experience, and I think so the danger is very real and deadly circumstances and anticlimactic circumstances can be represented in a totally different way. And that's a dishonor, I think, to the sacrifice that these people give.
This is The State of Things. We're talking today about war movies and the impression they leave on us about the lives of soldiers. Garrett Scott, director and producer of the documentary film Occupation Dreamland, is with us, and we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. Just ahead, retired Special Forces Officer Craig Marks will join us. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm David Crabtree. We're talking on this Veterans Day about the way in which the military is portrayed in the movies. Filmmaker Garrett Scott is with us, and we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. We're going to get to a call in just a moment. Garrett, first, I want to talk with you about a new movie that's out now, Jarhead. Mm-hmm. It's based on a memoir of a soldier from the First Gulf War. You have seen this movie, I understand. Tell me your impressions.
I thought it had some very interesting moments. You know, I think the material itself was quite fascinating. I think they probably took some liberties with the original material in order to make the script interesting. And it seemed to be a sort of slow moving, uneven film. But I don't know. All in all, I think it was a pretty serviceable film, especially in terms of trying to. Convey or represent the anticlimactic aspect.
Sort of the monotony of war?
Absolutely.
Okay, on the other end of that scale is a movie that many of us saw back in the mid-80s or late 80s in Full Metal Jacket.
Right.
Let's listen to a clip from that.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor. From now on, you will speak only when spoken to. And the first and last words out of your filthy sewers will be, sir. Do you maggots understand that?
Sir, yes, sir.
Bull, I can't hear you. Sound off like you got a pair.
Sir, yes, sir.
If you ladies leave my island, if you survive recruit training, you will be a weapon. You will be a minister of death praying for war. But until that day, you are pukes. You are the lowest form of life on earth. You are not even human beings. You are nothing but unorganized, grabastic pieces of amphibian shit. Because I am hard, you will not like me. But the more you hate me, the more you will learn. I am hard, but I am fair. There is no racial bigotry here. Here you are all equally worthless. And my orders are to weed out all non-hackers who do not pack the gear to serve in my beloved Corps. Do you maggots understand that?
Sir, yes, sir.
From Full Metal Jacket, and that scene, that opening half of the movie, based on this part with the drill instructor, our emotions went from laughing at this to just cringing by what we were seeing and hearing.
Yeah, I think it's an incredible film for a lot of reasons. He's a great filmmaker, but just the way, you know, the cadences of the actor is playing the Marine drill instructor, it's so amazing. Those guys are incredible characters, and they have a great sense of performance. You know, it's totally terrifying for the people under their power.
And, Garrett, you know, I was told that the guy who played the drill instructor was actually the technical consultant brought in, and they could not find an actor to carry it out as well, and he was an actual drill instructor that they put into that role.
It makes perfect sense, doesn't it? That's why it's so good.
Let's take a call from Sean in Greensboro. Sean?
Yes.
Thanks for calling us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention I was in the military for a short period, not really long enough to actually say I was in the military. But what I wanted to say was that the impression that I think most Americans get today from the military is that they get a really sense of what they go through, like your guest had explained. But also they see exactly what war actually can be. What is it? It's a very terrible thing. I think war movies have gone through a number of changes. Throughout the 50s and 60s, it was all about glorification and look at our mighty force.
Right.
And then the 70s, having Apocalypse Now coming out, and of course you just mentioned Full Metal Jacket, you start to get a sense of these are not just numbers we're throwing, they're actually people and what they go through. And I think with movies just like Black Hawk Down and one of my favorite war movies, Saving Private Ryan, you get a sense of what their purpose is and all the bureaucracy all they have to go through from their higher-ups of putting them in harm's way. And I think that's a really important message to send to viewers of what these guys have to go through and how they're done and how they're disposed with.
Right.
Sean, thanks for your call so much. He brings up Saving Private Ryan, which did speak to the monotony of what they were doing, but also to citizen soldiers, which we are dealing with now with so many of the reservists in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Right, right, right.
Craig Marks is a retired Special Forces officer. He now works as a consultant in Raleigh. He's joining us by phone, I think also coming from somewhere way out west. Captain Marks?
Good afternoon. How are you today?
Well, I'm fine. You sound like that drill instructor all of a sudden.
And Arlie Emery was, you're right on with the story. He worked 3 months with the actor and finally went up to the producer of the movie and said, I can't train this idiot. The guy goes, oh, you want the job? And the rest is history. So that's why he's so good at what he does.
And he went on to, continues to act in several roles.
Oh, sure. He's got a TV show and he was the voice on Toy Story and he's a whole second career.
Captain Marks, earlier we talked with Garrett about the role military films and documentaries fill in society. How do you respond to that?
I think two parts. One is that the documentaries, if there's not an agenda, are important, watching the History Channel, those kinds of shows. They're important to tell the story of what all these people go through. There's propaganda out there on both sides. My favorite movie, John Wayne, The Green Berets, that was pure psychological operations to try and win the hearts and minds, get them behind the war in Vietnam. But then you've got The Deer Hunter and you got some others that were, exactly the opposite. They were trying to go against the war. So,
right.
And one thing to consider and remember about movies is it's not about telling the story. The screenwriter may think that, and the director may think that, but the executive producer, it's all about making money.
Right.
And it's got to be what sells to the public, and that's why you see a lot of good books that when they make it to the screen, you're not quite sure it was the same book or not, because they take a lot of license to try and appeal to a broad audience. Now, having said that, war is a profession, an art, if you will, that is not... not the goal of every person in the world to partake of. So I think you get a lot of transference a lot of times of people that go and see the movie, and they personally wouldn't want to be in the military or wouldn't want to do that, so then they think, well, nobody should. And it can sway the public, it can build pride, it can get them behind the truth, but it can also do a lot of harm to morale and those kinds of things. And I think we need to be careful in some of the ways we portray our military, especially while we're in war as we are now.
Let's take another call. This is from Mark in Raleigh. Mark, thanks for calling us.
Hey, how y'all doing?
We're okay.
Hey.
How are you, sir?
Well, the comment I wanted to make was that the movies are good. All of the movies that I've seen over the years have been good. But the one thing concerning this war in particular, because there's going to be some movies that's going to spawn out of this, is that there is a issue of controversy on the administration as to whether we should have gone or not. If the movies do not bring that up, then it's not telling the whole story. I really do feel sorry for those men that are over there with this underlying question of whether or not they should have been sent in the first place. And I know that everyone is trying to build up morale to keep the men going. But it's a sad situation that's going on. And I hope that when they start portraying these movies, that they also bring up the fact of the issues or pending questions with the administration here to give the public a good spectrum of seeing this whole thing being played out, more so than just what someone said earlier about, you know, the Marines coming in mm-hmm. and killing off the bad guys.
And Mark, I think mm-hmm. if you take a look at Operation Occupation Dreamland, that's what you're going to see. Is that not right, Garrett?
I hope so, because that's what we encountered on the ground there, most definitely.
But I think, and you know, if we take a historical perspective, which is something we're really bad at as Americans, look at the lead up to World War II. It was appeasement. It was, you know, it's their war, not ours. We don't want to get involved. And after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there were those that called for negotiation instead of a full outright war. So I think, you know, there's got to be that debate in every society for every major event like that. But once the hammer goes and once we're into it, you know, now is not the time to decide that we shouldn't have been there and pull out. We need to finish the job, however poorly or, you know, whatever your perspective is how it started. We got to be there to make it right for the Iraqis.
Who defines, Craig, a finishing point?
Well, there's always the age-old argument of what is your exit strategy. We went into Haiti. We did a lot of things in the 90s. Where we didn't have an exit strategy. And even when we had an exit strategy, we didn't work. Remember that guy that said we were going to go to Kosovo for a year, 15 years ago? So, I mean, you know, we need to articulate, and that's where the military really needs to help the elected officials and Congress and whatnot to define what that exit strategy is. I think we have said that if the first two elections went well and the Constitution was adopted and now we're going for the third round of elections, if all those things went well, and they have so far, then we could start looking at withdrawing forces. And then the other piece of it was they had to get the Iraqi military trained up so that they could take care of themselves and there wasn't a power vacuum when they go. So, I mean, we have defined an exit strategy. Our issue right now, I believe, is that we, as the instant gratification society we are, aren't willing to put the couple of years necessary to start seeing results. Everything happens in an hour in our world on TV, so why can't it happen that fast overseas? So I think we've got a vision of what our exit strategy is. We just need to take some time to see those things come to fruition and make them happen.
And we are taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. When we're talking about military movies in a time of war, do these movies mean something different than they would if we were not at war at this time? Would they have meant something different pre-9/11, Craig?
I think so. I mean, I wrote a program for the Boy Scouts of America back in 1990. 1999, dealing with emergency preparedness. And the form letter I got back said, well, we don't believe this is the vision of the future for America. So timing is everything. So, if we had not had a 9/11, if we had not had some of the events that have occurred overseas, this would be in the realm of fantasy instead of historical fact. So I think in my view, everything changed on September 11th. And I think that's the big fight we have in America. You've got September 10th people, and you've got September 12th people. And we just have a different view.
Garrett, you mentioned, Craig Marks mentioned earlier, he used the word agenda as he talked about how documentaries and movies are put together.
Yeah.
Documentaries, though, are set with a tone that is different than a movie normally. Is that not right?
Well, they should be, but it really depends. I mean, there's a waning sense of the objectivity, possibly, of documentaries right now. I think especially in the last few years, as people that make documentaries realize that if you make them more sensational or closer to Hollywood films with a particular agenda, more people are going to go automatically because they'll be more entertaining or they'll preach to the choir. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the value of particular documentaries has been lost. because you can make you can get close to something like objectivity when you're looking at the phenomenon in the world outside of you, especially like war. And I think that's far more interesting than just, you know, trying to tell one side of the story or the other. You know, make the story appear like what you think it should be.
Let's take another call, this one from Barry in Raleigh. Barry, thanks for calling the State of Things.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I think one of the problems is movies and television give a distorted view no matter what the point of view is.
Yep.
Unlike World War II and more or less the Korean War, or definitely World War I, there's a distance and from what's actually happened. This, having cameras on the field, being there, people are prone to want things wrapped up neatly. The military is non-political. They just do what our elected officials, which we elect, tell them to do. Television and movies, no matter whether it's left or right, no matter how noble their causes are, when people get their information about war just through those mediums, it's distorted. It becomes, it's Toy Story, it's Star Wars. It's not really what happens on the ground. And I think we depend too much on media and the CNNization of that kind of information.
All right, Barry, thanks for your call. Guys, want to respond to that?
Yeah, I'd take that. I mean, we spent many nights at the beginning of the war, David, when I was doing the military analysts on WRL, we'd get a report in, and the producers would jump all over and say, oh, we got to write this up. And I'm like, well, you know, let's wait till we
right.
get all the facts. And it happens time and time again. And it doesn't have to be war. Look at Katrina. All the things they were saying about, you know, 10,000 dead in New Orleans and all these things. The first report is, and I don't ever say, you know, never say never, but, you know, the first report is never fully accurate. The moment is upon those people. They're reporting what they're seeing. There's excitement, there's adrenaline, those kinds of things. You need to step back and take an objective look. Unfortunately, what happens is the camera grabs that first moment, you get those first responses, and then once they report it, it becomes almost fact, and then it's hard to go back after the fact and tone it down and say, well, here's what really happened, because then it's like, well, you know, they're trying to cover up, they're trying to do this. So, you know, I think that the cameras on the scene do a great job of capturing the moment, but the analysis that needs to go along with that is oftentimes lacking.
All right, let's take another call here from Jim and Kerry. Jim, thanks for calling the State of Things.
Hi, gentlemen. After hearing some of your comments and in regards to my, I used to be a drill sergeant myself in the Army, I think a lot of the films miss an awful lot of the interpersonal stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. that really slants an awful lot of films. In the DI story, for instance, they never showed him handing out mail at 9 o'clock, and they never showed him every morning getting up at 3:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't mention the fact that most drill sergeants work 6 days out of the week. Sometimes, every other weekend, they work 7 days out of the week. And during that time and period, they're stressed with everything from live ammunition operations and teaching people first aid with gas masks on to leading them through gas chambers and without masks on. And all that stuff sort of adds up. And they in the DI, the story of the DI, all they show is the meanness of the DI.
Right.
And also, different wars have called for different things, I guess. And in World War II, I'm 60 years old. I was born at the end of 1945, so I did hear something about World War II, and it was completely different. The training process and everything was completely different from the Vietnam War.
Jim, do you have a favorite war movie?
I think my favorite war movie is probably the series by John Wayne known as the Frontier series, the three movies, Fort Apache, Rio Grande, and I forgot the last one, but those are my favorite war movies. I don't have anything that I can say is favorite about war in modern times.
Mm-hmm.
It all is pretty bad because the reality of it is pretty bad.
Jim, we appreciate your call, and happy Veterans Day, too.
Thanks a lot.
Garrett and Craig, favorite war movies for the two of you?
I can't say I really have a favorite.
Okay, let me rephrase that. Maybe not favorite, but the movie that spoke more deeply to you.
Oh, man. Craig, do you have one?
Well, I mean, the Green Berets with John Wayne,
oh,
just because
right.
I am one. But I think Full Metal Jacket, at least the first half, because I had that guy in boot camp.
Right.
You know, it hit home with the way that Emery did the drill sergeant, drill instructor. So those are my favorites. Technically, as far as telling the story, I like some of the ones from back in World War II because they made those in the 50s, and they had some, you know, it wasn't the rush of the moment.
Garrett, before you leave us today, the response to your documentary, how do you summarize that?
Oh, it's been fantastic. But what can I say? I mean, yeah, I can't tell. With the audiences we get, it's been really great. For me, personally, the most rewarding thing has been the amount of people that have come back from Iraq that attend the screenings. And
our thanks to Garrett. I'm going to have to stop you there. I'm sorry.
Yep.
But our thanks to Garrett Scott, director and producer of the documentary Occupation Dreamland, and Craig Marks, a retired Special Forces officer who now works as a consultant in Raleigh. Just ahead, the translated speeches of Osama bin Laden. Stay with us.